Hello, everyone. My name is Lavanga Vijayakorn. I am an attorney and shareholder at Littler Mendelsohn, a law firm specializing in labor and employment law. I am also a member of the firm's pro bono committee. As part of our commitment to pro bono work, each year, our firm identifies a call to action that focuses on a particular issue in our community that is in dire need of pro bono legal assistance. This year, our call to action focuses on the migrant families who have fled their home countries and are seeking asylum in the United States. These migrants come from not only Central America, but also South American countries like Venezuela and Colombia, as well as from other parts of the world like Haiti, Ukraine, Russia, China, India, and West Africa. They are fleeing their home countries for various reasons, including political, religious, or other types of persecution, as well as economic desperation. The U.S. immigration system is intended to process and grant asylum and other immigration protections to those migrants who have legitimate claims under the law. However, the system is broken and has been so for decades, with tragic consequences for those migrants who need protection the most. One of these consequences is currently playing out in many U.S. cities, like my home of Chicago, where migrant families are being shipped from the southern border and they end up on streets, homeless and vulnerable. Indeed, these new waves of migrant families, which include little children, often have no community or family ties to the U.S. and are therefore in dire need of shelter, healthcare, and food. This is where we, as attorneys, can help. I am honored to be joined by representatives from three nonprofits who work with pro bono attorneys in serving immigrants. They are from three different cities, Chicago, New York, and Denver, and we will talk about how attorneys in these cities and elsewhere can help these migrant families. I will start with my friend, Ellen Miller. Ellen, can you please introduce yourself?
Of course. Hello, my name is Ellen Miller. I use she, her pronouns. And I'm the pro bono manager at the National Immigrant Justice Center in Chicago. NIJC has been a long-term pro bono partner with Littler in advocating for human rights protections and access to justice for all immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers. I've been working in international protection for almost 20 years, and I'm honored to be here today. Jody, I'll hand it to you.
Yes, thank you. I'm also happy to be here today to talk about this really important issue. My name is Jody Ziesmer. I am the co-director of the Immigrant Protection Unit at the New York Legal Assistance Group, or NILAG. NILAG uses the power of law to help New Yorkers in need to combat social, racial, and economic injustices. I've been practicing immigration law for the past 20 years. I used to be in Chicago working for NIJC. I've also worked as a litigator, professor, and now as the program director of a direct service organization. I'll pass to Laura.
Thanks so much, Jody. I'm Laura Lund, she, her, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Litigation at Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network, or REMAIN, located in the Denver metro area here in Colorado. We serve the Rocky Mountain region and provide counsel and social work support to families and children, with a particular focus on unaccompanied minors and families in expedited removal proceedings, as well as adults in immigration detention.
Thank you, Laura. So the first question for each of you is, how has the recent influx of migrant families manifested in each of your cities? Ellen?
Yeah, so immigrants from all walks of life have really been an integral part of our communities throughout Chicago's history. Being a sanctuary city has been a part of the city's identity for nearly 40 years. Governor Abbott of Texas began putting individuals and families on buses to Chicago last fall because of the sanctuary policy. In the fall of 2022, we received approximately 17,000 individuals within 6 weeks. Many of these people had no ties to Chicago. Many were unfamiliar with U.S. geography and the distance between themselves and Chicago. Their family members were randomly placed on buses to other cities and where the government had assigned their court dates. Chicagoans have sought to support a humane welcome for people arriving here by bus and by other means. And when people arrive, they need to have basic needs met, like Lavanga said, including shelter, access to healthcare, and then more importantly, sometimes access to information about their situation and their options. So in response to this mass influx of people, the city, the state, and civil society organizations established a multi-agency resource center in Chicago, and we called it the MARC. And here at the MARC, people received information and connected with essential services around the city. When we as NIJC, however, started to address legal needs, we quickly realized that people were in a wide range of procedural postures. There was seemingly no pattern to how people were processed when they crossed the border, and this added layers of complexity to how we needed to set up systems to respond to their varied needs. I guess overall, from our perspective, the city government and the people of Chicago have shown up for these new neighbors in a really generous way and as best as we can, but it still remains a challenging situation. I'll turn it over to Jody now.
Yes, thank you. So New York City has rapidly also become a destination for many of these families. It's estimated that we have received approximately 160 to possibly 200,000 families in the last year and a half. People are coming to New York because of our international reputation as a city of immigrants, and also because of our relatively generous policies regarding shelter and access to healthcare and public benefits. But as Ellen mentioned, there was also some exploitation of the crisis by politicians to score points against liberal sanctuary cities. So we also first saw the first waves of migrants we saw were being bused from various different states along the southern border, mostly Texas, but also we did see people flown in from Florida. New York City has responded to welcome immigrants, volunteers from the mayor's office and from civil society and from nonprofit organizations, greeted buses and triaged urgent needs of families for more than a year. But the city has also enacted policies to restrict and limit access to shelter for immigrants and have set up sort of a parallel shelter and benefit system that falls really below the standards that the city provides to others. For example, requiring immigrants to stay in tents on the outskirts of the city or in unpopulated islands, converted warehouses that are forcing people to stay in there, and limiting the access to homeless shelters to 30 or 60 days. Those regulations were just recently imposed, and it's caused a spike in street homelessness, thousands of children being disenrolled from school, and has really wreaked havoc on immigrants' ability to seek and obtain asylum or other status. Laura, how have you seen this play out in Colorado?
Well, there's definitely been a lot of overlap between what you and Ellen just described. Unfortunately, we also received some buses from Governor Abbott in Texas, which really expanded the politicization of this issue across various regions in the country. But the way in which the influx of people took shape in Denver varied slightly, just because we're a much smaller community than, you know, Chicago and New York. And so I think they also attracted much less national attention. That said, though, proportionally, we received more people than any other community in the country. What many people don't realize is that Denver is really just a 10-hour drive north of El Paso, Texas, which is one of the busiest border crossings on the southern border. And so that's part of the reason that our community here has received so many folks. And another factor that's very different from New York and Chicago is the lack of pre-existing networks of people from a diverse swath of countries. We have really strong immigrant ties to northern Mexico for the reason I just mentioned. We're pretty close to it, going back generations, and even parts of Colorado were parts of Mexico for a long time. So we have, you know, deep roots with the Latinx community here, but again, mostly coming from like Chihuahua and Michoacan in Mexico. But we also have refugee resettlement communities from places like Vietnam, Ethiopia, Eritrea. But where we don't have robust communities would be people from Venezuela and Colombia, which has been the vast majority of people arriving in the past year and a half or so. And that meant that most people did not have a safe place to land upon arriving in Colorado, and instead had to create a new community for themselves that could offer support and ensure their well-being. So, you know, the city of Denver has created a shelter system that they're wrapping up now. So some folks were only allowed to stay for short stints of time. Some families were allowed to stay a little bit longer. And we have really harsh winters here, just like in Chicago and New York. And so I think that the winter season really played a huge role in trying to make sure that the city stepped up. But now that the warmer months are coming, I think that they're taking a step back from that. And so now it's trying to figure out what is the next step for our community. Lavanga, I'm going to pass it back to you and see what you think our next step should be.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what each of your organizations is doing to address the situation. Ellen, shall we start with you?
Sure, happy to get this one started too. Well, there's always a lot to do. And I'll also just note that not only with this population, right, but with all of the immigrants that have been in our cities, but I think due to the surge of arrivals, and like my colleague said, without that host community, it's been a challenge. So challenge means opportunity. And with our incredibly supportive and pro bono communities, though, I think we're doing a lot, and I think we're doing a pretty decent job of it. So since August of 2022, NIJC has worked with the city of Chicago, the state of Illinois, and pro bono attorneys to try to respond to the legal needs of these new neighbors. As I mentioned, soon after the first buses arrived from Texas, it became clear that the families' first priorities were to find stable housing and reunite with families. So our role there, we considered, was to provide Know Your Rights tools to help people once they were ready to tackle their immigration cases. Information is power. And then last summer, as the one-year deadline started to approach for asylum, NIJC launched monthly asylum clinics with pro bono partners. And to date, we've hosted 11 clinics with pro bono partners across the city and have thus provided legal support to more than 100 asylum seekers and their families. And of course, we're very, very excited that this next month of May, Littler will be hosting our next workshop in Chicago. At the court, so NIJC staffs the immigration court helped us. This means that we're right outside the court doors and we provide legal orientation for people who arrive for hearings but have no counsel. As you may or may not know, immigrants are not provided counsel. And so if they can't afford it or they can't find it, they will go pro se. And many of these people need help changing their venue for their cases or just knowing even what is going to happen, what to say, and what are their options. So we have a staff that helps there. At the end of 2023, so this past winter, the city, the state, and partner organizations also established legal clinics for this population that were currently in city shelters. These clinics prioritize temporary protected status, work authorization, and then early 2024, the city, state, and partners added additional clinics to help individuals with these triage legal services, such as change of venues and change of addresses. Something that could be seemingly so simple, like where is your court, actually was not a simple question because of the way this whole situation unfolded. So there was a lot of support that is needed and was needed. And NIJC provides trainings and supervision for the legal volunteers at these citywide workshops in Chicago. And then almost circling back or maybe just underlining that first point, I think one of the most important things we can do is provide regularly updated materials that digest changes in the law, the policy, and practice. Immigration law can change by the day. It can change by the administration. It can change by the month. And it can change suddenly without worrying. And so making sure our new neighbors, our community members, and our legal community know what is happening and how to respond to that is really critical. So we've been doing a lot. We will continue to do a lot. But I know we've also learned a lot from New York and what they've done or what they weren't able to do. So I'll hand it over to Jody.
Great. Yeah, thank you. So New York City is fortunate to have a robust legal services network. I just want to circle back a little bit to what Ellen was talking about and just kind of paint the picture of what the needs are. So because the U.S. federal government has chosen to route every newly arrived immigrant who is crossing the southern border, with the notable exception of Ukrainians, for whom a separate and generous program was created, everyone else is being routed through a deportation and surveillance system. So there's a lot of urgent needs because there's a lot of deadlines and pitfalls. So first, every immigrant has to attend an immigration court hearing to defend themselves against deportation, to apply for asylum if that's the form of relief that they're seeking, and they will have an individual adjudication of their case, which involves a trial, presentation of evidence. And as Ellen was mentioning, this involves, you know, they're not appointed counsel. There's also strict deadlines to apply for asylum. So people have to apply within 1 year. Temporary protected status for nationals of certain designated countries have other deadlines for which they have to file for relief. And then apart from all those deadlines, immigrants are also really eager to submit applications for immigration status, to open the door for employment authorization and identity documents, and to be in compliance with our laws. So to reiterate, it's education and information is super important. People are coming from countries with various different systems and laws and are not familiar with our immigration system, what their obligations are and responsibilities, and what are some of the deadlines and processes that they're going to go through. So providing that information, I think, is really critical. NILAC has also done a lot of that, creating videos online for people in various different languages, in community presentations. We've partnered with the city to disseminate information and get a lot of our materials translated into the many different languages that newly arrived immigrants speak. We also host regular events like NIJC does, where we provide individual consultations and advice to people, just answer their questions, assist people in identifying the form of relief that they're eligible for, and then helping them either pro se to fill out applications, to file them before deadlines, or pair them with pro bono attorneys, pair them with other providers who can provide more full representation for the entire process. So all of this obviously needs a lot of resources. I think we're doing as much as we can, but unfortunately, we're seeing already a lot of people slipping through the cracks and not able to meet their filing deadlines. And because of all of these other needs with shelter, with taking care of children, getting urgent health care met, immigration often is not a top priority for people, or they don't understand what they need to do to get on track for their immigration case, which can cause really dire consequences. So we're trying as much as possible to fix mistakes that have been made, to reopen cases where people have already been ordered deported, and to help as many people who are in the pipeline to make sure that their due process rights are respected. All right, I'll pass to Laura.
Thanks so much, Jody. I feel a sense of camaraderie with you and Alan, just hearing all the things that y'all are up to. And it's very similar in Denver, underscoring like the main goals at this point is really just to try and make sure people have access to due process and fundamental fairness, because we are drinking from a fire hose in terms of how many folks have arrived so recently and just the needs in terms of their asylum cases, temporary protected status. That said, I really wanted to focus on one area that we're seeing a lot of need for in Denver. And just to contextualize it, as of the end of last year, there were only about 20,000 pending cases, the dockets here in Colorado. And as of February of this year, there were more than 70,000 cases. And a recent study revealed that Colorado and New Mexico are actually tied for the lowest rate of access to counsel in the country, with just 14% of people having an attorney. And I think that that ties back to something Ellen was saying, and that I think all of us would like to reiterate, that people have the right to an attorney in immigration proceedings, but they do not have a right to court-appointed counsel. So if they cannot afford an attorney, they will not have one. And in some instances, even when people can afford an attorney, there's just not enough attorneys to go around because the need is so great. So compounding the problems associated with that radical shift in the growth in our docket, at the same time, the Biden administration enacted the Family Expedited Removal Management Policy, or FERM, and it's a new form of deterrence for families. So the policy created an additional screening stage with asylum officers before families can access the immigration judicial system. So what does that look like? Let's paint a picture of this. So interviews take place in a government office where most families appear before an adjudicator who's talking to them over a speakerphone. The person's not even physically in the office with them. They cannot see the government official, and the official cannot see them. If they don't speak English, which very few people do in this situation, they also have a telephonic interpreter who's neither in the room with them nor in the same place as the asylum officer. So there's a lot of room for error and miscommunication, just given the complexities and how these interviews are taking place. So let's up the ante a little bit. In addition to those barriers, they also have their small children in the room with them while they're supposed to be explaining to this hidden stranger the details of the most traumatic experiences that they've faced in their lives that caused them to flee for fear of being killed. If they don't receive a favorable fear finding, they are referred to an immigration judge for a truncated version of an appeal. If they are unsuccessful, they are sent back to the places that they fled. The Department of Homeland Security's goal is to deport these families within 30 days of arriving in the United States, but provides no meaningful opportunity to ensure that they have access to counsel. According to initial statistics collected about this program, only 2.6% of families attended their review hearings with an attorney by their side. In response, Remain has constructed a pro bono program specifically geared towards serving these families, in addition to the other folks that we've already talked about. And we've negotiated with the government to get a list of families enrolled in the FIRM program in Colorado. And through that, we reach out to them as soon as they arrive in our community and try to connect them with information and counsel as quickly as possible. But that's certainly an area where we need more pro bono attorneys to plug in and help support these families.
Thanks, Laura. Now that you've all given a wonderful view of the background of the situation and what your organizations are doing in general, the question I have for you is, how can Littler attorneys or any other attorney who's out there listening help your organization address this situation? Ellen?
Yeah, thanks, Lavanga. We are just so grateful for Littler's commitment to providing legal services to our immigrant communities and also really to our whole pro bono network. It really would not be possible without you. The need for legal assistance, as my colleague said, it exceeds our ability to provide pro bono support. There are many ways to get involved in current hot topic pro bono topics via short-term engagements. For example, as I mentioned, Littler is hosting one of NIJC's Pro Se pro bono asylum workshops this next month. And around the city of Chicago, there's different ways to get involved. These one-day workshops provide really critical support to the start of a very, very complex process. And this brings me to another perspective on how to get involved. Immigration matters are long-term matters because our immigration system is collapsed. Accessing justice is critical, but justice is not served until a decision is rendered. And a lot can happen between the start and finish. At NIJC right now, we have over 70 cases for which we seek pro bono support and advocating with the client to obtain justice. And I'll also mention, I think we're one of the few jurisdictions and circuits in the country where we can say this, but NIJC, we win 90% of our asylum cases. In other areas of the country, that win rate can go down to as low as 10%. That's not for lack of trying, but that's because of all the barriers within the system. Pro bono attorneys do make a difference. We have extensive technical support models already established to support pro bono attorneys with their clients. And when pro bono attorneys support these clients, our staff can pivot also to address urgent and developing situations and to develop additional pro bono projects. So really, pro bono público, it really does take a village. We appreciate all the support in supporting our new neighbors. Jody?
FundILEG is always eager to increase our reach and capacity by collaborating with law firms and volunteers. We focus mostly on community-based events, so we do anything from screening events where we see people either on a walk-in basis or we're seeing people for the first time and just getting an assessment of what their needs are, giving them some advice, to hosting workshops where we actually help people apply for asylum, temporary protected status, work authorization. So we rely on volunteers and pro bono firms to host a lot of these events physically in their offices, but also to provide the staffing and volunteers for that event. We have trainings, we have support throughout that process. For some of these applications, particularly temporary protected status or TPS, requires the immigrant to pay a fee to the federal government. And we do ask for some support in helping immigrants file those to meet those fees. We also mentor pro bono on taking actual cases. As Ellen mentioned, this is really critical because having representation for these processes is essential for securing due process rights, but also to be able to present the claim and actually win. We also have like fairly high approval rates here in New York, but it really depends on having representation, having an attorney by their side. And I'll just note, I don't know if this is true in other jurisdictions, but in New York, we have an accelerated track. It's called the dedicated docket. So some newly arrived immigrants actually will have their entire asylum case heard in front of a judge within a year of their arrival. So these cases do move fairly quickly. We also are happy to place some cases that people have appeared pro bono and lost and are now litigating an appeal, which can be an attractive tight posture of case because it doesn't involve being present in court. It's all done by a written briefing. We also have other opportunities that don't involve client engagement, but we have firms do research and develop templates and country condition evidence that can be used for pro se applicants. So, for example, we partnered with a firm recently to develop a pro se packet of materials for LGBTQ asylum seekers from Ecuador. We have another firm develop evidence package for political dissidents from Guinea. So there's a lot of ways that we can engage and support, and we're always eager to engage people and volunteers and firms in innovating around how we can meet the various different needs. Laura, I'll pass to you for what's happening in Denver.
Well, as I can say time and time again, the same things are happening here as in Chicago and New York. And Jody, something that you mentioned, the dedicated DACA is fast and furious here in Denver, for sure. And the program I was talking about, the Family Expedited Removal Management Policy, those families, if they get referred to immigration court, if they get a positive fear finding, then they are put onto the dedicated docket. So these cases are basically being litigated twice and both at really, really rapid rates. And this is really the first time that we're seeing anyone outside of a detention facility being placed in expedited removal, which is this very, very fast process with the initial screening interviews happening with the asylum office. And those decisions just assess whether or not somebody ever gets to see an immigration judge. So that's why it's so critical for people to have access to counsel to understand what is asylum, especially when we're talking about such a discrete timeline. I mentioned 30 days. So these cases move really, really quickly. And who are we talking about? Like very cute little families, lots of whom have small children up to teenagers. And they're having to, within weeks of arriving in the United States and maybe experiencing housing insecurity, they're also having to articulate why they should qualify to seek asylum here in the United States, which is a pretty intense thing to have to explain, right? The substantive elements of asylum law are complicated, and it's really a new concept for a lot of folks to understand how to apply facts to law. And part of our job is to explain that to people. So this explanation is all a lead up to say that we have a great need for attorneys who can provide these families with a brief overview of what is asylum law, to listen to their experiences and distill the components of their legal claims that are most important to share with an asylum officer during a very brief interview. Providing people with roadmaps for how to explain their fears in a way that is clear and easily understood while also offering framing for how to present a legal claim has one of the greatest output to impact ratios an attorney can possibly make. You completely change the trajectory of a family's life. They can fight their case here rather than being deported to danger. So what is it that we're asking for? We need attorneys who are willing to help parents and kids enrolled in firm, who can offer preparation appointments, which really last about 2 to 3 hours and explains all of these components of the case and helps people frame their case so that they can proceed pro se and continue fighting their case. Remain offers training, technical assistance, and robust practice resources to make it as easy as possible for attorneys to step into this space, regardless of whether or not they have any immigration background. And this is a resounding theme that I keep hearing from Ellen and from Jody, is that all of our organizations, we put a lot of time and thought into explaining how all of this works, into setting pro bono attorneys up for success. And it is incredibly rewarding to be able to see pro bono attorneys thrive in this space and to come back and tell me years later, this is like the most meaningful thing that I've done in my professional career. And so I just want to say thank you so much to Littler for providing this space to help us explain why this is so critical and important, especially in this moment. And so I will hand it back to you, Lavanga, to close us out.
Thank you, Laura. And thank you, Alan, Jody, and Laura, for sharing with us your valuable insight on the plight of these migrant families and how we as attorneys can help. And thanks to you and each of your organizations for all the work you do to serve these immigrants. I believe that to the extent our immigration system functions at all, it is in large part due to the great work that you all do day in and day out. I hope that this podcast inspires all those attorneys out there to connect with NIJC, NILAG, and Remain, or any similar immigrants' rights organizations to assist these migrant families. As Ellen mentioned, as part of our call to action on May 29th, the Littler Chicago office is collaborating with NIJC in hosting a clinic for migrant families, during which 15 or so Littler attorneys will be putting together and submitting their asylum applications. We have had an overwhelmingly positive response to this clinic so far, and all the spots are taken. Beyond these clinics, of course, Littler attorneys have the opportunity to protect the rights of various pro bono clients, from veterans to domestic violence survivors to even animals. At Littler, we proudly provide 100% billable credit for any pro bono matter, up to a maximum of 100 hours per year per attorney. Finally, please consider how your corporate clients might want to partner with you in handling a pro bono matter. Our attorneys have reported that working with their corporate clients on a pro bono matter based on a shared passion for a cause has been an incredible experience. I'll leave you with that thought. This is Lavanga Vijaykorn, thanking again Ellen, Jody, and Laura for their time and invaluable insight. And thank you all out there for listening. Bye.